Each failure is a step closer to success. You're listening to episode 2 of Learn With Us. I'm Ken.
And I'm Nikos. Learn With Us is a podcast for developers that want to learn how to teach programming.
Hey Nikos, how are you today?
I'm great this happy morning. I've just opened a kind of Diet Coke, which is really helped right now.
That's the best way to wake up. And yeah. Actually, last week we talked about you were going to teach ES6 and async await. So can you tell me, how did that go?
Well, we haven't got onto async await yet. We'll get onto that soon. Yeah, ES6 is quite a fun thing to teach. It went quite well. Students generally quite like that topic. So covering things like, you know, promises, string interpolation, object deconstruction. We're going to get through quite a lot. Arrow functions,
string interpolation. You know, those two things right there make ES6 really powerful.
Totally.
Did you cover object shorthand notation? Have you covered that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That really makes constructing an object super simple. Cool. So, were there any snags? Did any of your students have to kind of come back and touch some ideas? You had to kind of walk them through it slowly?
I think in general, not just like my current students, but like arrow functions are quite hard to understand. You know, I think if students have trouble with arrow functions, you kind of have to go back to, you know, closures and, you know, lexical scoping, or what does this equal in certain contexts, and how this can change depend whether it's on an event listener or a timeout, and where it's declared and stuff like that.
Right, and if you happen to say assign a function, you took an object that had a function on it, and then you move that function into a different scope, you know, how does what does this become in that case? Goes kind of back to where JavaScript, you know, has the bind and call methods on them. But
yeah, I think any student of JavaScript really has to have a deep understanding of that, and then how to understand like what's happening under the hood with, you know, things like ES6 classes as well. You know, how like it's not actually, there isn't actually a classes in the runtime. It's all done with prototypes. I mean, but who knows? I mean, in Chrome and all that stuff, who knows how it's done underneath? Maybe there are classes in Chrome now.
I do think that they're still using prototypal inheritance. I don't think that they're going to move away from that because it's written into the spec. But it all does come back to JavaScript needing to be backwards compatible to. You know, so you could write the newer syntax, but at the end of the day, they want to be able, as new features come along, they want it to be able to degrade gracefully to something less. So the tooling that's built into like Babel and TypeScript and these, you know, transpilers, it all is based on the fact that JavaScript will eventually still run, like we can still get down to ES3 syntax. You know, just kind of chop off those bits that they added. But I do think that having the core concepts of JavaScript is important before you start to get into what is a class, and arrow functions are, you know, making the language powerful. But you know, at the end of the day, if you don't have the knowledge of what prototypal inheritance is, then you could find yourself confused down the road.
Yeah, my students appreciate me teaching them how to use just vanilla JavaScript. Sometimes in the past, you know, I've went straight into like a framework, but I'm not really sure how that worked in the long term for them. Maybe they've had to go on back and just relearn the basics of JavaScript, or maybe even they don't even know the basics of JavaScript, they're still using the framework.
Well, there is a thing about frameworks, right? I mean, so when I got started, most of what I knew how to use was jQuery. You might think of that as like the gateway drug, like gets you into JavaScript or into the language. And yeah, it might today be, you know, not favored as much, but at the same time, it got me interested. It kept me interested. And
yeah, back time, in 2010, I used it a lot.
Yeah, and over time, sure, I didn't reach for jQuery very often anymore. And now I use Angular pretty heavily. But still, I think back to when I first started, and I was like, well, I want to have this thing pop up on the screen when a user clicks a button. Like, you couldn't do that with just HTML and CSS. You know, now you can kind of do it, and you can hide and show things a little bit with CSS, but still, you have to do some pretty funky stuff to get there. And jQuery made it super simple.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you didn't have any experience in JavaScript, knowing how to use jQuery gave you some leverage, you know, gave you a little bit of skill over the guy that just knew how to use CSS or HTML.
Sure.
But, you know, if you don't know JavaScript, then it's fine as long as you have something to fall back on. I think jQuery was a good tool to learn.
Yeah, I mean, even today, it's still useful and still used on a lot of websites. And you can probably write some code quicker with jQuery than you could with vanilla JavaScript, but I just find that the vanilla stuff is kind of... you don't have to learn two things, so to teach some new person some code, I don't bother teaching them jQuery. I could probably cover it in like a framework section.
Right. If you wanted to say, hey, like, I'm going to introduce you to Bootstrap, or I'm going to introduce you to Foundation, you know, yeah, those types of, you know, CSS or JavaScript frameworks. Those aren't real JavaScript frameworks, but, you know, they're close enough that they can get people interested in JavaScript.
Yeah. So I'm also teaching some of my students how to use Webpack, but I'll briefly cover Grunt and Gulp, but I won't bother with any code examples. All the code examples will be in Webpack, because I think that's just a tool that's kind of going mainstream. It's just such a good tool.
You know, I didn't believe it. I heard them talking about bringing in WebAssembly to where you could use compiled C code that would run in a browser and bundle it with Webpack. And apparently now that's official. They actually can do it, or have a branch that's capable of doing that, where they have a Rust code or a Rust application that's being imported into JavaScript or WebAssembly, and Webpack is bundling it. So that's crazy.
I've seen some games that are done that way, and they're just playing on a console, but they're on the browser.
Yeah, I mean, our machines are powerful enough to do it, so I guess I shouldn't be too surprised that it's happening. But the fact that this is being brought into a JavaScript environment makes me think that JavaScript is really more powerful than I actually thought. You know, yeah. Not to say, I guess this is WebAssembly, not necessarily JavaScript, but it's still the web platform, and we're going to, as the web grows, we're going to get more and more powerful things like it.
Yeah, the browser to me is the best content delivery system that there's ever been. It's
just, right.
You know, the standardized system, it's just great.
Yeah, I mean, sure, it sucks when IE6 is brought into the picture, but that's, you know, 10 years ago. But, you know, where it's come since 93 or whenever it was.
Yeah, one of my clients really needs to support Chrome, which I'm absolutely loving right now.
Oh,
I can get away with so much stuff, man.
Yeah, so a lot of the clients I work with, they are line of business applications, so they internal tools for their company, so they get to dictate who their, you know, what their employees use on their machines, right? So a lot of them do say, no, you got to use Chrome, or even if it is IE, it's like IE 11 or Edge sometimes is better, but sometimes Edge doesn't have like all the built-in plugin systems like Chrome does. So, but yeah, if the company says Chrome is the only browser we care about, then that makes things so much easier.
Yeah, totally.
Oh man.
Long day.
Yeah, I'm looking at this list here. Don't worry, I'll edit this out. All right, are you editing this time?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, I'll do it this time. Yeah. I think there was some Pepsi that I burped her for a few seconds. I'll definitely edit that out.
So I wanted to ask you, when you go into if you have a new assignment and you're like going into a company and this is the first time you've met these students, like how do you assess them before you get started? Do you like tell them ahead of time, hey, these are the things that you're going to need to know before we can actually start this class? So you get kind of give the company a heads up like a few weeks beforehand, like what you're expecting the students to already know before you walk in there. Is there something like that that you do?
I've not done that. Well, I typically just give them a repository to check out, and once they check it out, then we can. My lessons are so hands on, so quick though, that they don't really need much pre warning. They just need to download the repository, with Git and stuff like that. And if they can do that, they can start to learn to code pretty quick.
I know that when on the courses that I've written, Treehouse has quite a big library of courses, and a lot of times we'll just decide upfront like who is this course for. In the case of my latest course on Angular, we decided that the course was for the intermediate student, maybe not the advanced student, but a student that has already gone through all of the beginner courses that Treehouse has to offer. And we kind of lay those courses out that set, you know, beforehand, so to tell the student, before you get into this course, you're going to want to take this Intro to JavaScript or ES 2015 I can't remember what all they had, but they had like some Node courses and, you know, we gave them enough information to say, hey, before you come in here, you're going to want to take these four or five other courses. And I know that that's made it a lot easier on me when I'm writing the course to know upfront, like who my audience is and who's going to be there, because there's times where you might get into a place of describing something, where you feel the need to go back and say, okay, this is what a function is, and this is what, you know, classes are, and kind of get down to basics. But when you know that the student is more advanced, then you can kind of shave that stuff off and leave it behind. And if the student does feel like they need to go and investigate that, you can point them in the right direction, but you don't need to spend the time on it. So is when you're doing the courses in these companies, you know, how do you approach that when a student might feel like they don't know exactly what you're talking about? Do you give them like some direction as to how to learn more about a topic, or do you walk them through that right there at that point so that they can continue with the class? Kind of puts the class in a place where they're waiting on one student, but how do you work with that?
Well, it depends how much time you have at your client. If you've only got, you know, 2 days or a week, then you're not going to have enough time to really tailor every student's individual needs. So yeah, I have strategies for that. You know, you can pair them together, weaker ones and stronger ones, or you know, if you have a longer time at the client, then you can do one-to-one things to sort of bring them up to speed with the rest of the class. But I do always kind of recommend to, you know, students to go home and, you know, anything you don't understand, make sure you understand it before the next lesson comes. Just try and, you know, go online, do some Googling or write your own, you know, examples.
Go find some Stack Overflow questions and see if you can answer them, that kind of thing.
Well, yes, that's a good idea as well. You know, that's some of the questions in Stack Overflow probably a bit advanced for them, maybe, because, like, a lot of stuff's already been asked, and the new stuff that's being asked is often kind of challenging.
Yeah. So one of the things I personally like to do is I like to go find the top. Like, I'll go find a question on Stack Overflow and read all of the answers. You know, it's got to have like 3 or 4 decent answers, and maybe a lot of comments about the answers. I like to find one that just kind of, it's the most voted for or whatever it is, and I like just try to prove it wrong. Like, how, what did they miss, or where's, I might not respond or anything like that, but I like to at least challenge myself to say, how could this be better? A lot of times you'll see on Stack Overflow that the answers might not directly relate to the question that was asked. It might just be somebody tried to, you know, boil it down to a couple of lines, and so if you can go and find one of those questions with an answer like that, you know, you can learn based on the information that was already given, and you can start to put things together. So maybe they won't answer the question if you put them on that task, but they can at least read the question and read the most upvoted answer and be able to piece together that code themselves and say, oh, this is how I'd solve it if I wrote this answer.
Yeah, a lot of questions that have been asked a long time ago, sometimes the answer will change. You know, the technology will change.
Yeah, technology hasn't stayed the same. Just talk to anybody that's writing React today, and they'll tell you that six months ago, React was a totally different beast.
Yeah, I've not even got a chance to build my latest, you know, React app in React XP. I just discovered something new that this week was like something called Create React Native App. So I'm looking at that now, and that's another thing to learn, another build tool to make a React Native apps. And I still don't understand it yet. I mean, I fired up this Create React Native App, and there was some kind of QR scanner that came up. And I was like, what is this? So, yeah, another thing to learn.
Huh. Yeah, so I've been trying to level up with NativeScript, and every time I try to get started with it, I just fail miserably. So I installed the NativeScript command line tool, and then I started to install like the Android Studio and get my environment set up. And man, I must suck at setting up environments, because I cannot for the life of me get it to run the emulator for the life of me. It's the most difficult thing I've ever done.
React Native has been one of the worst development experiences I've ever had.
Here we are just shitting on React Native and NativeScript. Sorry, guys. Your stuff is awesome. We suck.
Yeah. Maybe I have to have an IQ of a take an IQ test where you start to, trying to develop with React Native.
Yeah. but yeah, I really want to get up and running on, you know, native script, because I have a side project that I'm trying to help a friend with, and hey, it would be great to not only help my friend but help myself by learning this new thing, and I, you know, just can't get over the hump.
Is that for building mobile apps?
Yeah, native script is for building mobile apps. So I almost said mobile like you, but no, I said mobile.
Yeah.
So it's for building iOS and Android apps, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, English language is like quite funny with the sounds. I think just like yesterday, I actually learned the correct pronunciation of vehicle. All my life I've been called vehicle. And then I had a look at the spelling, and I had to spell it from one of my YouTube videos, and I'm like, oh wait, that's why people are always saying vehicle, because that's what it's supposed to be sounded like, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
And
we're
native English speakers, you know. And
it's the most confusing language to anybody that doesn't speak it too, so it's not,
yeah.
It's really hard for me to, like, there's so many other languages that I don't know. I only speak English. So all the other languages that I don't know have a much stricter, framework, or, you know, there's more rigidity to other languages, and English is so loose. You can say whatever you want. Eventually somebody's going to know what you're saying, but I don't know. It doesn't make all the sense in the world.
Greek is quite a fun language to speak. Yeah. And also, one language I'd love to learn is Mandarin. I just think that sounds so cool.
The word Mandarin?
No, just the language. When you listen to people that can speak Mandarin, I just think it sounds so cool.
It
sounds, yeah.
Yeah, I tried to learn Spanish when I was in high school, and I was no good at it. And now my kids probably know more Spanish than I do.
Yeah.
Just by the nature of how our schools are, you know, a lot more Spanish speaking students in my kids' classes these days, which I think it's great that they're getting the culture that I didn't have, you know.
Yeah, useful language.
How's Manchester? Have you been?
No, I was there a couple of years ago, and I'm going up again for a conference in October. But yeah, when that happened, like, it didn't actually sink into me, absorb it, until like a couple of days later. I woke up and I felt a really kind of downer about it. Just like, this has actually happened here, and I just can't imagine what it'd be like for the people that have experienced it. I mean, it's probably a lot of post-traumatic stress. I actually once in my life heard a bomb go off in Greece, and I think it was done like about 2 a.m. or something like that, so it was kind of planned, so just to kind of make a statement. So I don't think anybody was injured. It was like a car bomb outside a bank, basically. I think it's just, you know, anti-bankers stuff. And I was actually up at that time for whatever reason, and the bomb went off about, it must have been about 2 or 3 miles away, and it just felt like nothing I've ever heard in my life. It was terrifying.
Anybody hurt during that time?
I don't think anyone was hurt, but I just never heard anything like it. It was like a firework, but in a whole different category of firework. It was like,
right.
It was a different sound. It was like a shockwave, actually. It was, I mean, even for 2 or 3 miles away, I didn't feel anything physically, but it just the sound of it. I mean, so, and that was scary. I was a bit scared for like a few days after that.
Yeah. Did you feel like you couldn't even go? You couldn't go anywhere?
No. I could go outside, no problem. But it was just like, It's horrible, you know. It's like, you know, you watch all these you know, blockbusters, and you see lots of explosions, but if you ever like hear one of those things in real life, it's completely different to anything you've ever experienced. So people that have been in Manchester, I mean, you know, it's just going to be absolutely, it'll affect them for the rest of their lives, you know, psychologically as well. You know, people physically, of course, it's absolutely horrible, is horrible, but the psychological damage is, I can imagine, will be a lot of, you know, possibly, you know, people needing help from you know, from PST.
Sure. And then, you know, I just can't imagine what it was like for not only the people in the stadium, and but the parents that are waiting outside for their children. You know, a lot of those kids, they were so young. Like, I think that some were even younger than my... So I have a 11-year-old and a 9-year-old daughter, you know.
Yeah.
I think they were younger than that. You know, I've heard it... I could have swore I saw some kids that were like 7 or 8 years old in there. And I just can't imagine, like, waiting for, did my kid make it, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's unimaginable.
Yeah. It's just, yeah. It's just pure evil, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think it was last year, maybe longer than that, but there was a mass shooting here in Oregon, and that was, it was scary, but, you know, nothing compared to what happened this last week with the stabbing that happened here in Portland. What happened was this man that's supposedly a Nazi. At least he marches in white supremacy stuff. Anyway, he was yelling and screaming at these young girls, one Muslim girl, and these three men just, you know, stood up and protected her, and you know, they lost their lives, and this guy is going to jail. But, you know, I saw him on the news today, and he's screaming at the people in the courthouse as he's getting his hearing, and the hate that he, you know, he has in him, it's only going to get stronger outside in the world, where, you know, people are, you know,
it's just kind of hard to relate to, you know, how can a person get to that state, you know?
Right. You know, I hope that he gets the help he needs, and I hope that, you know, I just wish it never happened, you know? Just seeing that stuff is just terrible. You know, where it happened, I've ridden that train. I used to live in that area. You know, it's not too far from
the train.
Yeah, so it would happen on our MAX transit, which is, you know, the daily commuter to get in and out of the town, or in and out of the city.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just sad that people will take another person's life because they're afraid.
This just seems like there's more and more of these things happening in Europe. This has been an absolutely terrible year for, like, I don't know, it's just like every month there's something happening in Europe, you know?
Right. So I'm kind of wondering, I might be totally off base here, but I think that our connectivity, the access that we have to the internet, is making the world a worse off place because of the news travels so quickly. You know, 60 to 100 years ago, people would have never, ever even heard about attacks in Europe. You know, they might have heard of it like 3 or 4 days after it happened, and it would be this diluted series of headlines. Like, it would not be as prolific as it is now, right? I think our access to news is poisoning the minds of the people.
Yeah. So in terms of even Manchester, there's a lot of people scared in London. You know, I mean, commuters and stuff like that, especially, they're just like, just having, like, some people are just afraid to come into work, you know. This happened when I had the bombings in the, you know, the undergrounds and stuff. There's a lot of fear going around.
Right, yeah. I mean, people don't want to work in skyscrapers, you know, due to 9/11. So it's not unheard of that, you know, people, once these things happen, they're going to want to stay away from wherever those things happened. Yeah. And it's sad because that's exactly what these people want. They want you to be afraid to go out of your own home.
And one of the scary things is sort of the random nature of it, because, like, you know, you would never expected, you know, you'd have thought that these radicalized, you know, hateful people, they're, you know, the target, like, I don't know, whatever they want to target, but, like, to go after kids, I mean, it's completely random, and
it's heartless.
You know, yeah.
Like, it truly is the worst attack ever to target kids.
Yeah.
I don't know. Not much else to say about it, but
yeah.
I just hope that we, you know, can all come together and things will stop happening, or, you know, we'll stop giving it the attention. You know, when things get bad, we'll look at the good and not the bad. So that these hateful people don't have anything to look forward to.
Yeah.
Well, that's a gloomy note to leave on, but I think we're done. I think we're at our 30 minutes.
Yeah, good talking to you, Ken. Yeah. Have a good a good sleep, and I'll have a good day training people.
All right. Sounds great. Hey, thanks for listening to Learn With Us.
Yeah,
please
thanks,
rate
guys.
The show on iTunes. And 5 stars only. Take care. Hey, oh, before I go, I may open a Twitter account because I was told on the Shop Talk show that I need to have a social profile.
That sounds good, like a good idea, yeah.
I may open one. Not 100% sure.
Okay.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Bye.